Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
And welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, the UN Security Council makes changes to the mandate for the UN mission in South Sudan.
It is also our hope that UNMISS peacekeepers will be better prepared and equipped to respond more effectively in protecting civilians, themselves and their installations.
And we'll be hearing how a militant Islamist attack on Nigeria's security forces spilled over into a neighbouring country.
I will tell you, Boko Haram attacked Ngambaru and seized a lot of materials from the armed forces, Nigerian armed forces. Where did the Nigerian soldiers escape to? They escaped into Cameroon territory.
Do stay with us for the next 25 minutes.
Top story.
The United Nations Security Council has decided to restructure its peacekeeping mission in South Sudan. The emphasis will now be on protecting civilians, monitoring human rights, and implementing ceasefire agreements instead of on nation building. The move comes after months of fighting between government forces and rebels in South Sudan, in which thousands have been killed and more than a million displaced. The new UN mandate runs until November the 30th, and the world body has warned both sides that they could face sanctions if they obstruct the pursuit of peace and reconciliation. James Shimanyula reports.
As the situation in South Sudan remains volatile, the United Nations Security Council has officially authorized its forces there to use all necessary force to protect South Sudanese population. About 12,500 United Nations troops and more than 1,300 policemen have been stationed in South Sudan. South Sudan representative to the United Nations, Francis Mading Deng, underscored the UN's great concern in protecting the civilians.
The government of South Sudan appreciates the fact that greater attention is being placed on the protection of civilians, given the gravity of the crisis the country is going through. It is our hope, however, that there will be no more tragic crises as the parties are striving to restore peace and reconciliation. It is also our hope that with the refocusing of the mandate and the lessons learned from previous experience, UNMISS peacekeepers, who have at times put their own lives at risk to protect civilians, will respond more effectively in protecting civilians, themselves, and their installation.
The United Nations has had an uneasy relationship with the Juba government. Just a few months ago, Juba accused the UN of arming the rebels after they found out that the UN has mislabeled arms transported from Ghana to South Sudan as construction materials. Reflecting on the renewal of the mandate, Deng said,
although our government has had some reservations about some of the elements in the renewed mandate, we hope that with our shared concerns and better communication, our cooperation will be enhanced. The government of South Sudan is well aware of its limitations to meet fully its commitments and aspirations for the protection of its citizens. The legacy of the long war, stretching over half a century, has left deep wounds that will take long to heal.
The wounds that Deng is speaking about have been made worse by nearly 6 months of fighting between government troops and rebels supporting former Vice President Riek Machar. As the fighting continues, the UN has projected that there could be up to 1.3 million internally displaced civilians by the end of the year. According to United Nations Humanitarian Coordinator for South Sudan, Toby Lansa, the displacement raises food security concerns as the rainy season sets in at the beginning of next month. Lancer has already appealed to the government to actively participate in the process of providing assistance to civilians, citing out one of the measures that the government can take to help civilians, Lancer said.
A good and simple measure would be to help those people in Juba who are showing interest in going back to the neighborhoods from which they fled in the middle of December, help those people go back to their neighborhood in a tangible way. Give them some building materials, give them a Ministry of Health clinic, give them some mattresses, anything that they may need to help them rebuild their lives.
That report was compiled by James Shimanyula. For more on how this new mandate will impact on the ground in South Sudan, I turn to Ariane Quintier, spokesperson for UNMISS in Juba. More than 80,000 civilians were already being given sanctuary in camps. What changes were going to be made?
I think it's not only that is going to change. It's the entire approach that we have to South Sudan. Where the mission was established in 2011, South Sudan was a country at peace. The country needed to be built, institutions needed to be built. So it was a nation building and state building mandate where, as well, there was always the provision for protection of civilians, human rights monitoring and documentation. What we'll have right now is that we'll have an emphasis on the protection of civilians, not only because we've got almost 90,000 civilians who have found safety on our bases, but also because we have tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of civilians who are currently fleeing the violence in the country. And this mandate of protection of civilians also includes protecting them, all of them, from violence and deterring violence to fall upon them.
Now, the Security Council has authorized the mission to use all necessary means to protect civilians. How likely is it that UN troops could get embroiled in the fighting between the forces of President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar?
I don't think we are there at all, and I won't be reading a crystal ball. I think very clear that all necessary measure within the deployment and within the mandate, and that's also very clear in the resolutions. It's too early to say how will they. The idea is certainly not to get into any sort of fighting with any of the forces. On the contrary, it's to support the peace process in any case, and it's also having within the mandate and the troops authorized by the mandate itself, three battalions that will be coordinating the monitoring and verification teams, as well as the Joint Technical Committee of IGAD themselves, making sure that the ceasefires and other halt of hostilities agreed upon on the 23rd of January and 9th of May are being respected.
How is the restructuring of the mission going to affect relations between the United Nations and the government of South Sudan?
The relationship between the government of South Sudan and UNMISS have improved drastically in the last since the month of January, where the mission got under so much criticism. You may recall that on the 6th of May, the Secretary General of the United Nations met with the President of South Sudan and the President of South Sudan in a communique, but also talking to the press. So he made it public, reiterated his commitment to the mission and the desire, the willingness to continue cooperating and improving the cause of cooperation with the mission. This new mandate is also has been shared with the host country, which is South Sudan, and it's been already commented by South Sudan.
Isn't this latest decision by the Security Council an admission that nation building has failed in South Sudan?
No, I don't think the Security Council is thinking that the efforts have failed at all. I think the Security Council is taking stock of a new situation, which is that since the 15th of December, there are two sides, unfortunately, in conflict, the President and the Vice President is sacked, and that the Security Council would not have been responsible if it had not taken stock of the new situation, and that a state-building mandate is not what the country needs right now. We're more with the country, which is in conflict, and we need to respond to that.
Ariane Quintier, spokesperson for UNMISS in Juba.
Africa Link, every weekday on Deutsche Welle.
Cameroon and Chad have deployed a total of nearly 2,000 troops to their respective borders with Nigeria. The aim is to try and contain the threat posed by the militant Nigerian Islamist group Boko Haram. In the past, Cameroon has been criticised in Nigeria for providing a safe haven for the militants, whose most recent suspected attack killed 31 security personnel in Yobe State late on Monday. From Yaoundé, capital of Cameroon, Moki Kinseka reports.
Cameroon soldiers sing in excitement as they leave the capital, Yaoundé, for the border with Nigeria. They will join their counterparts from Chad after Presidents Idriss Déby of Chad and Paul Biya of Cameroon declared that they were waging war against Boko Haram Islamists. Cameroonian military spokesperson Colonel Didier Bajek told me the soldiers will collaborate with the population in finding members of the violent group. According to him, the deployed troops from Cameroon and Chad were aware they will be confronting a group that uses unconventional methods of warfare.
We have occupied the field so that the response should be more spontaneous. I want to say that we need a total cooperation from the public. This will encourage us in the field to know exactly that people are thinking about us and are supporting their defense forces. We especially await information from the population.
Cameroon's defense minister, Edgar Alemebengo, said the military from the two states will cross over to Nigeria and fight Boko Haram in collaboration with Nigerian forces. Nigeria has quite often accused Cameroon of not doing enough to fight Boko Haram that operates in the West African country and cross over to Cameroon. Awa Fonka Augustine, governor of the far north region of Cameroon, where Boko Haram has attacked several times, says those who blame his country of not helping Nigeria should be informed that Boko Haram was an internal problem in Nigeria before now.
We could not get involved in an issue happening in another country, so we had to limit ourselves with our territory. I think this phase now is that we are getting involved and getting disturbed because they are trying to get themselves into our territory.
Just recently, suspected Boko Haram members attacked a military post in the Cameroonian border town of Kuseri, freeing one inmate. Then there was an attack in Waza locality in North Cameroon. 12 vehicles and a container of explosives were stolen. Several Cameroonian soldiers have been killed in addition to the kidnapping of 10 Chinese workers, 7 tourists and 4 clergymen. Fonka Awa says Boko Haram can no longer be seen as a Nigerian problem.
I will tell you, Boko Haram attacked Ngambaru and seized a lot of materials from the armed forces, Nigerian armed forces. Where did the Nigerian soldiers escape to? They escaped into Cameroon territory. They rushed and surrendered at the Jamaica that we are Nigerian soldiers. We are in trouble. Help us and keep us here. So that's the situation. And that's how they are now exporting their problems into our territory and the far north region in particular.
Far northern Cameroon, where the troops have been deployed, has a population of about 3 million people. Some 30,000 people have sought refuge as a result of Boko Haram activities in Nigeria. It is feared that any attack on the Nigerian Islamist group may destabilize the area.
Maki Kinseka reporting.
Behind the headlines.
French nuclear manufacturer Areva has reached a deal with Niger's government to continue uranium mining after promising to pay more taxes and invest in local development. Critics say the country's uranium riches aren't translating into wealth for its citizens and have accused Areva of exploiting Niger since it began operations in 1971. Niger is the world's fourth largest uranium producer. Reason enough to take a look behind the headlines in this report written by Julia Hahn and adapted for Africa Link by Assumpta Latus.
After months of discussion between the government in Niamey and the French nuclear energy company Areva, Niger's Minister for Mines and Energy has the signature in his bag. It confirms that the French nuclear company Areva will continue to extract uranium ore in Niger for the next 5 years, but now in accordance with conditions set by the government. Omar Hamidou Tiana is Niger's Minister for Mines.
Ils ont intéressé beaucoup de personnes au-delà même de notre pays.
The move drew a lot of interest from people from outside the country. It has also mobilized the political and parliamentary authorities of both countries. In the name of transparency, we shall communicate this agreement to you. For Niger, the agreement is fair and balanced and has satisfied all sides.
Under the new deal, Areva must now pay up to 12% in taxes on the uranium ore extracted, instead of the previous 5.5% as required under the country's mining law of 2006. For the government in Niamey, this is a huge success as Areva has previously benefited from hefty tax benefits. The company did not pay export tax for the uranium ore or corporate tax, according to reports published in early 2014 by news agency Reuters, which were based on confidential information. According to Niger's Minister for Mines, this meant the country was losing some 30 million euros, equivalent to $40.8 million annually. Areva's CEO, Luc Aucel, said he was also satisfied with the deal.
Mais notre histoire commune, ça n'est pas simplement une histoire industrielle.
Our shared history is not only an industrial history, there have also been ties between our teams for decades. With the signing of the strategic agreement, a new chapter will now be opened in the history of uranium ore extraction in Niger.
Et surtout nous projette dans l'avenir.
But Nigerian activist Nuhu Azika is not convinced that things will change with the new contract.
For years, the state has irresponsibly allowed huge sums of money to slip through its fingers. That is highly untransparent, and we do not know whether the general population and the mine workers will really profit more in the future.
More than 60% of the population live on less than a dollar a day. Those who work close to the uranium ore extraction sites or live nearby face serious risks to their health. The mines at Arlit are surrounded by millions of tons of radioactive waste material. Dayat Hassan is from the Center for Democracy and Development in neighboring Nigeria.
There is a little or no awareness on the health hazards of this uranium mining. There is a lot of course, radioactivity concentration in the air, in the water, in the soil. Who is cleaning up?
In 2010, environmental watchdog Greenpeace published a report saying that the level of radioactive contamination around Niger's uranium ore mines was 500 times higher than normal background radiation.
That report was written by Julia Hahn. In December, Kenya's parliament adopted a new media bill under which journalists and media outlets are policed by a special new quasi-governmental body. The legislation also foresees huge fines that could force media outlets to shut down. The passage of the bill was described by Kenya's Union of Journalists as a dark moment for the country's robust media environment. And newspaper front pages declared that democracy and free speech were under attack. Henry Miner works with the Africa program of the media rights watchdog Article 19. He visited us recently here in Bonn for a Deutsche Welle conference on the state of the Kenyan media. My colleague Isaac Mugabe asked him what the impact of the law had been since it was passed 6 months ago.
The law has largely weakened the media operating freedom. And as we speak now, there are a number of organizations that are in court challenging the constitutionality of the law. And the law weakens the operations by two things, that it begins to give a government hand in proscribing how journalists would operate. So when the Media Council of Kenya law does not make that provision clearly, but it seems to be subordinated to the Kenya Information and Communication Amendment Act of 2013, which was also signed on in a short span after the Media Council Act. But the Kika law clearly provides sanctions that are a bit threatening, because it provides sanctions on the journalist as an individual and the media house with which they are affiliated. But it also has provisions like a journalist who commits a professional breach could be barred from practicing journalism as one of the sentences. Not that that would be a last resort sanction if you've breached the professional ethics before. It could be you've just done this for the first time, you're apologetic, but the media tribunal has already decided you'll never be a journalist anymore.
During this year's World Press Freedom Day, the president criticized the media for breaching the code of conduct by writing damaging stories. Were his remarks justified, or was that an attempt to intimidate the media in Kenya?
I think one of the things that should be very clear is that the media is there to do an objective work, and that if the stories the president cited, one of the media houses had ran a story on the cost of the cabinet retreat, and he said that the figure they quoted was not truthful. But my question is, where else would the journalists have gotten the information if the government did not say how much it cost? And that access to information is still problematic. We don't have an access to information law. So this journalist has to do his investigation by trying to circumvent legal hurdles. And that the journalist lived in the same hotel with them and got a quotation from the hotel saying this is how much the hotel room costs. So he did his mathematics. And yes, there could have been an error, but that is not a big professional breach to worry about. But for me, the question was that is the presidency willing to be held accountable? I hear and I heard what the president said, but my reaction to him was, make as much information publicly available and journalists would make less mistakes on facts.
Kenya enacted strict laws against hate speech following the 2007-2008 post-election violence. How difficult is it to find a balance between freedom of speech and expression, for example, on social media, vis-a-vis hate speech?
The understanding of what hate speech is remains a very fluid concept, legally and even in practice. So there are many other acts of speech that may be offensive, may be abusive, but they do not fit into hate speech. What has turned out in Kenya that hate speech has become a bad name. You can give any dog and hang it on. So we need to be able to understand that, yes, the laws require states to prohibit incitement to violence, incitement to hatred, and incitement to discrimination. And when that happens, states can prohibit that incitement by a number of mechanisms. Criminal law is only one of them, but not the only one.
Henry Miner from the media rights watchdog Article 19. You're listening to Deutsche Welle's Africa Link, coming to you from Bonn.
Opinion.
Earlier in the programme, we heard how the Security Council has made alterations to UNMISS in South Sudan. The emphasis is now going to be on protecting civilians, monitoring human rights, and implementing ceasefire agreements. After the new resolution was passed, South Sudan's ambassador to the UN, Francis Deng, addressed the chamber.
It is also our hope that with the refocusing of the mandate and the lessons learned from previous experience, UNMISS peacekeepers, who have at times put their own lives at risk to protect civilians, will be better prepared and equipped to respond more effectively in protecting civilians, themselves, and their installations.
What are your feelings about the new Security Council mandate on South Sudan? And how do you view the UN's record in that country? Let us hear your opinion in a text message to country code 49 160 957 59510 and email to feedback.africa@dw.de or in a letter to Africa Link DW 53110 Bonn, Germany. Before we leave you, a quick reminder of our main stories. As we've been hearing, the UN Security Council has refocused its mandate for South Sudan. Cameroon and Chad have deployed nearly 2,000 troops to their borders with Nigeria in a bid to contain the threat posed by Islamist militants. And the French nuclear manufacturer Areva has reached a deal with Niger's government to continue uranium mining, after promising to pay more taxes and invest in local development. Africa Link will be back again at the same time tomorrow. Do join us if you can. As always, thank you for listening. This is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.